A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So we've been talking in some recent episodes about the rental crisis here in Israel and around the world. I think in Israel, it's more than a crisis about the lack of regulation and tenant protection law, so much as it is about what often feels like a lack of political will to actually take this issue seriously. I mentioned that I think that this is the rental crisis we have here, in which tenant protection law is weak enough that landlords can kick out tenants for essentially no reason. They might have woken up on the wrong side of bed. Even if that was the only problem about our tenant code in Israel, and it's far from the only problem, that would already be a massive problem, because it means that even if you're the best renter in the world, the most model renter who pays your rent 1 second after it's due, you take care of all the bills for the landlord, which I've often found myself doing, repair the place for the landlord, and you can still find yourself, the contract is a year, after, you know, 9 months into that contract, or 10 months, the landlord can say, yeah, I just don't feel like renting anymore, sorry buddy. And if you live with that constant sense of, I don't know if my lease will be renewed, how can you ever expect people to feel anchored, not just in a community, but as humans? And that's the, you might call it a psychological point, but that's the deeper point that really disturbs me about the rental market. I mentioned that Hannah and I, in the context of our current rental fiasco with the leak and the landlord who decided to just end our tenancy, have had a couple of brush-ins with Israelis where we just felt, well, this person just doesn't understand it. We consulted with a lawyer who was excellent, gave excellent advice about our rights. She was a superb legal representative or counsel, but her attitude was kind of just buy a place already. It's no big deal. I mean, kind of said, well, do you know how much it costs to buy property in this city? And when we talked about how much moving costs and how hard the moving process was, essentially, the lawyer who we consulted with was maybe an Israeli woman in her 50s, maybe later, and had owned property since she was in her young 20s. And didn't really understand how crazy the dynamic had become. And when we told her about how much her latest move cost, there was kind of an awakening, or, you know, she kind of got it in a way that she definitely didn't. Now, this has got me thinking about a bigger question, which is the people we elect to our parliaments. I mentioned that there was an attempt to reform tenant law in Israel that was basically a big fat failure. And the people who are trying to bring these laws on our behalf might not be the people who actually understand the context that they're trying to pass laws about. And I think that this rental crisis is one that we mentioned that, you know, the solution might be to actually getting this where it should be on the political agenda, that if these dynamics continue, we're going to have a body by the time at which the people who can get on the property ladder constitute the majority of the political bloc, form a critical mass. Suddenly they won't have to put quite as much effort into mobilizing and organizing. Until then, we might be the youngsters, relatively speaking, trying to convince our elders in parliament about what's actually going on. The question I'd like to ask Herman and Corin is this question about disconnect between those who sit in parliament and, by doing so, dictate what's on the legislative agenda to a great deal. I've mentioned that in Israel, I feel like our permanent position is we're debating these grand issues of Jewish identity and state, which are great and important conversations, but they're not the most relevant conversation for someone who's trying to find a stable place to live for their family. Have there been any experiments into creating a parliamentary body that is constituted not just based upon who the people vote for? And I realize this may be a different system entirely to democracy, but which ensure that each demographic block of the population, whether it's an age cohort, have their issues represented. My issues of trying to get on the property ladder might not be relevant to a parliamentarian in their 50s who've come from that generation of Israelis that got in on property when it was far cheaper. Likewise, the issues that matter to me are probably not the same as those that are important to people in their 70s and 80s who are concerned about healthcare and retirement. And if we have a parliament that's homogenized by a certain people from a certain socioeconomic class, but also by people dominated by a certain age group, we can see very easily how we might have a functional democracy. But we're electing people whose vantage point is very much narrowed by their own lived experience. And I'd love to explore this topic and ask more concretely about any efforts that have been taken around the world to try to create a representative democracy that wasn't just representative of who the people voted for, but of the actual perspectives in the parliamentary hall. Over to you.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's actually two questions folded together. The first is about the psychological toll of living with zero housing security. Knowing your landlord can end your tenancy essentially because they woke up grumpy. The second is bigger. If our parliaments are dominated by people from a certain age and socioeconomic class, whose lived experience is decades removed from the problems they're supposed to be solving, has anyone tried to build a legislative body that represents actual perspectives rather than just who won an election? It's a question about democratic design, and honestly, it's the kind of thing that sounds radical until you realize how many places have already tried it.
The rental piece is the perfect case study for why this matters. Israel's tenant protection law is among the weakest in the developed world. No-cause eviction is perfectly legal here. A landlord can decide, month 10 of a 12-month lease, that they're simply done with you. You've paid every shekel on time, you've handled their maintenance bills, you've been the model tenant, none of it matters. The legal framework doesn't protect continuity. It protects the landlord's whim.
Which is wild when you think about the asymmetry. The landlord holds the asset. The tenant holds nothing but a piece of paper that says, "Please don't make me move my entire life on 30 days' notice."
That's exactly the psychological dimension the prompt is getting at. There's a concept in housing economics called ontological security, the sense that your home is a stable base from which you can operate as a person. Build relationships, join community organizations, let your kids stay in the same school. When your housing tenure is perpetually provisional, you don't plant roots. You can't. The soil might get yanked out from under you next season.
The lawyer anecdote really lands for me. You consult an expert. She gives you excellent technical advice about your rights, and then her big picture takeaway is just, buy a place already. As if the idea that someone might not be able to do that had simply never occurred to her.
Because she bought when a Jerusalem apartment cost what? A fifth of what it costs now relative to income. She's not being malicious. She's operating from a mental model formed in a completely different economic reality. And that's the structural problem. When the median age in the Knesset hovers in the mid-50s, and homeownership among that cohort was achieved under conditions that no longer exist, you get a legislature that doesn't feel the urgency. Not because they're bad people, because the problem doesn't live in their bones.
Let's get into the question. What are the actual experiments in building representative bodies that don't just reflect voter preference, but reflect the demographic and experiential makeup of the population?
The term you want is sortition, selecting political officials by lottery rather than election. And it is not some fringe idea from a political science seminar. It was the foundation of Athenian democracy. The Athenian Council of 500 was chosen entirely by lot from a pool of citizens. Juries were chosen by lot. Most administrative positions were filled by lot. Elections, to the Athenians, were considered aristocratic, because elections favor the rich, the famous, and the well-spoken. Sortition was the democratic mechanism.
Which is a complete inversion of how we think about it now. We've naturalized the idea that voting equals democracy, and anything else is some weird technocratic experiment. But the people who invented the word democracy thought voting was the oligarchic option.
And the Athenian system ran for about 200 years with sortition at its core. Now, obviously, it had massive exclusions. Women, slaves, non-citizens. We're not romanticizing it. But the mechanism itself has a philosophical logic that's hard to dismiss. If you believe that ordinary citizens are capable of making reasonable decisions about public affairs, then a random sample of those citizens should produce a body that thinks like the population thinks.
The counterargument is that ordinary citizens aren't capable, that you need expertise, that you need people who've dedicated their lives to understanding policy, which is also the argument for having a professional political class.
And that tension between democratic legitimacy and governing competence is the central problem for every sortition proposal. But here's where it gets interesting. We're not just talking about ancient Athens. There are real functioning examples operating right now.
Give me the ones that actually worked.
Ireland is the poster child. In 2012, Ireland convened a constitutional convention to consider several reforms, including marriage equality. The convention had 100 members, 66 randomly selected citizens, and 33 politicians. The citizens were selected by a survey company to match the demographic profile of the country by age, gender, region, and socioeconomic status. They met over multiple weekends, heard expert testimony, deliberated in small groups, and produced recommendations. Their recommendation on same-sex marriage went to a referendum in 2015, and Ireland became the first country to legalize marriage equality by popular vote.
The Citizens' Assembly was the catalyst.
The political class had been avoiding the issue for years. The Assembly broke the logjam. It gave cover to politicians who wanted to move but were afraid of backlash, and the process was considered so successful that Ireland kept doing it. They convened a Citizens' Assembly on abortion in 2016, which led to the referendum that repealed the Eighth Amendment, then another on climate change, gender equality, biodiversity loss. Ireland has essentially developed a parallel democratic infrastructure. Randomly selected bodies that tackle the issues elected politicians are too conflicted or too cautious to touch.
The mechanism for breaking a political logjam is to hand the decision to people who don't have a political career to protect.
That's the theory, and it's not just Ireland. In 2019 and 2020, France convened a citizens' convention on climate. 150 randomly selected French citizens, mandated to propose measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by at least 40% by 2030 in the spirit of social justice. They met over 7 sessions, heard from experts, and produced 149 proposals. President Macron initially promised to submit them to a referendum or parliament with no filter.
I sense a but coming.
Yeah, the but is significant. Macron walked back the no-filter commitment. The government ended up implementing only a fraction of the proposals, and in diluted form. The Citizens' Convention on Climate became a case study in how political leadership can embrace the legitimacy of a citizens' assembly while quietly defanging its output.
The assembly works as a deliberative body, but it's still at the mercy of the executive or legislature that commissioned it. It's advisory, not binding.
Which is the central design question for all of these experiments. Do you want a permanent citizens' chamber with real legislative power, or do you want a temporary advisory body that can be ignored when it becomes inconvenient? Most governments prefer the second option.
Are there any examples of the first?
The closest is probably Belgium's German-speaking community, which in 2019 established a permanent citizens' council. It's a small region, about 77,000 people, but it's the first permanent sortition-based institution with real deliberative power in the world. The council is composed of 24 randomly selected citizens who serve for 18 months. They set the agenda for separate citizens' assemblies on specific issues, and their recommendations go to the regional parliament, which is obligated to respond. Not necessarily to adopt, but to give a public, reasoned response.
That's a meaningful constraint. If you have to explain publicly why you're rejecting the output of a representative sample of your own constituents, that's a different political calculus than just ignoring a report.
It creates a feedback loop. The Citizens' Council can revisit issues if the parliamentary response is inadequate. It's not a one-shot process where the assembly dissolves and the politicians wait for the attention to fade.
What about age representation specifically? The prompt's core concern is that a parliament of 50-somethings who bought property decades ago can't viscerally understand the precarity of a 30-year-old renter. Has anyone tried to engineer age balance into a legislative body?
Not through sortition alone, though that's the obvious mechanism. A random sample naturally produces age diversity if the sampling is stratified. But there are interesting experiments with reserved seats or quotas. Uganda reserves parliamentary seats for youth representatives. Rwanda reserves seats for youth and for women. Morocco has a consultative youth council.
Symbolic representation is the musical equivalent of beige wallpaper. It's there. It doesn't offend anyone. It doesn't do anything.
The actual power dynamics don't shift. The youth representatives get to speak, but the legislative agenda is still set by the majority coalition, which in most countries skews older. In the United States Congress, the average age in the Senate is around 64. In the House, it's around 58. These are not bodies that feel the rental crisis in their bones.
The Israeli Knesset is younger, but not by much. And as the prompt points out, the agenda is dominated by questions of security, identity, the peace process, issues that are genuinely existential, but also crowd out the granular economic concerns of people trying to build a stable life.
There's a compounding effect. If young people don't see their concerns reflected in the legislative agenda, they disengage. Parties invest less in courting young voters. The policy feedback loop reinforces itself, and you get a parliament that increasingly represents the interests of older, property-owning, politically engaged cohorts.
Which is a functional democracy that slowly stops functioning for a growing share of the population. The prompts point about the critical mass, that eventually the people locked out of the property ladder will constitute a majority voting bloc, assumes that those people will organize around that identity, but political identity is sticky. People don't necessarily vote their material interests in a clean way.
That's the great complication. The Marxist assumption that material conditions determine political consciousness has been falsified about 1,000 times. People vote their identities, their cultural affiliations, their religious commitments. A 32-year-old renter in Tel Aviv might vote for a party that represents her values on security or religious pluralism, even if that party's housing platform is essentially trust the market. The preference bundle doesn't cleanly disaggregate.
The sortition argument sidesteps that problem entirely. You don't have to convince renters to vote as a bloc. You just put renters in the room.
Not just renters. The point of stratified random selection is that you get the full distribution. Homeowners, renters, people who inherited property, people who are couch surfing, old, young, urban, rural. The deliberation is supposed to surface perspectives that electoral politics filters out.
Let's talk about the actual mechanics. How do you run a citizens' assembly without it becoming a circus or a rubber stamp?
The OECD has codified best practices based on the hundreds of these that have been run globally. There's a report from 2020 called Innovative Citizen Participation and New Democratic Institutions. It identifies several design principles. First, the mandate has to be clear. The assembly needs to know exactly what question it's answering and what will happen with its recommendations. Second, the selection has to be random and stratified, usually by age, gender, geography, and sometimes by attitude toward the topic, so you don't get only enthusiasts or only skeptics.
Attitude stratification is interesting. You want the full range of priors in the room.
If you're doing an assembly on housing policy, you want people who think the market is fine and people who think it's a disaster and everyone in between. Otherwise, the deliberation is just an echo chamber with better demographics. Third, the process has to include genuine learning. Experts present evidence. Advocates from different positions make their case. The participants get to question them. Fourth, the deliberation is facilitated by professionals who ensure that everyone speaks, that no one dominates, that the quiet voices get heard.
This sounds expensive and slow.
It is both. The Irish Constitutional Convention cost about 1.5 million euros. The French Climate Convention cost around 5 million euros. A citizens' assembly is not a cheap way to make decisions. But compare that to the cost of bad policy. The French government spends billions on housing subsidies and tax incentives that distort the market in ways nobody planned. A 5 million euro deliberation that produces coherent, publicly legitimate reform proposals is cheap by comparison.
Assuming the recommendations are implemented, which brings us back to the Macron problem.
Which is the democratic tragedy in miniature. You convene a representative sample of the population. You give them expert briefings. They spend months deliberating. They produce thoughtful, balanced proposals that command broad public support. And then the elected government, which commissioned the whole thing, says thank you very much and implements the parts it already agreed with.
The citizens' assembly is political theater.
That's the cynical read, and it's not entirely wrong. But the Irish case suggests it doesn't have to be that way. The difference in Ireland was that the recommendations were tied to a referendum process. The Assembly didn't just produce a report that sat on a minister's desk. It fed directly into a binding public vote. Politicians couldn't quietly bury it because the whole country was watching.
The referendum is the enforcement mechanism. The Assembly deliberates, the people ratify, and the politicians are bypassed on that specific question.
Which works for constitutional questions and big binary choices. It's harder for something like rental market reform, which involves dozens of interlocking policy changes. You can't run a referendum on whether to amend Section 4, Subsection B of the Tenant Protection Law.
For complex regulatory reform, you're still dependent on the legislature actually doing its job. The Assembly can recommend, but the elected body has to legislate.
Unless you go further and create a permanent second chamber selected by sortition. This idea has been floating around political theory for decades. The political scientist John Bernheim wrote a book in the 1980s called Is Democracy Possible?, where he proposed replacing elections entirely with randomly selected policy committees. More recently, the Belgian experiment and the Permanent Citizens Council in Paris are testing scaled-down versions of this.
What's the Paris model?
Paris established a Permanent Citizens Council in 2021, 100 randomly selected Parisians serving for 1 year. They could be consulted by the city council on specific issues, but they can also self-refer. If they decide an issue needs attention, they can put it on their own agenda. Their recommendations go to the city council, which has to debate them publicly.
The track record.
Mixed, like all of these. They've produced thoughtful work on participatory budgeting and urban greening. The challenge is that the city council, which is elected, still holds all the formal power. The citizens' council has moral authority, but no legislative teeth. It's a conscience, not a lawmaker.
A conscience with 100 heads and a facilitation budget.
Which is better than no conscience at all, but is not the structural reform the prompt is asking about. The deeper question is whether we can design a system that guarantees representation of perspectives, not just preferences. And that's a fundamentally different way of thinking about democracy.
Unpack that distinction. Preferences versus perspectives.
An election aggregates preferences. Do you prefer party A or party B? Do you prefer this policy or that one? Preferences are snapshots. They're what you want right now, given the information you have and the options you're presented with. Perspectives are deeper. They're shaped by your life experience, your social position, your material circumstances, your generational cohort. A parliament of 55-year-old property owners might prefer policies that help renters. They might vote for rental subsidies or modest reforms, but they don't bring the perspective of someone who's been rent-evicted twice in 3 years. They don't know what that does to a person's capacity to plan, to save, to parent.
The prompt's lawyer story captures exactly this. The lawyer was professionally competent, probably personally decent, and had no idea what moving costs for a family in Jerusalem actually look like in the current market. Not because she was incurious, but because her perspective was formed in a different economic geology. She's living on a different stratum.
The problem compounds when you have an entire legislature living on a different stratum from the people whose housing crisis they're supposed to be solving. They can read the statistics. They can be briefed by experts. But the statistics don't produce the visceral understanding that comes from lying awake at night wondering if your lease will be renewed.
The sortition argument says you can't brief someone into having a perspective. The only way to get a perspective in the room is to put a person with that perspective in the room.
The objection is obvious. What about expertise? You don't want a randomly selected citizen performing brain surgery. Why would you want them writing housing law?
That analogy collapses immediately. The Citizens' Assembly isn't being asked to draft legislation from scratch. They're being asked to deliberate on values, priorities, and trade-offs after hearing from actual experts. The technical drafting is still done by legislative staff. The Assembly sets the direction.
That's exactly how elected legislatures work, too. Members of Congress aren't personally drafting the text of complex regulatory bills. They're voting on direction and leaving the details to staff and committee counsel. The expertise objection proves too much. If it disqualifies citizens' assemblies, it also disqualifies elected parliaments, unless every member has a law degree and a policy PhD.
Which most of them don't. The Knesset has lawyers, former military officers, journalists, activists. A random sample might actually have more occupational diversity.
There's a fascinating study from 2019 by the political scientist Helene Landamore. She argues that cognitive diversity, having people who think differently because they've lived differently, is more important for good collective decision-making than individual expertise. A group of randomly selected citizens will outperform a group of experts on certain kinds of problems because the experts share blind spots. They've been socialized into the same assumptions. The random group questions things the experts take for granted.
The lawyer, who never questioned that buying property is just what adults do.
That assumption isn't expertise. It's a cultural artifact of a specific generation in a specific country at a specific moment in housing market history. And it's invisible to the people who hold it until someone who doesn't hold it is in the room.
Let's talk about the actual political prospects for this. The prompt mentions an attempt at tenant law reform in Israel that failed. What happened there?
There was a proposed reform to Israel's rental law that would have introduced longer minimum lease terms, restrictions on no-cause eviction, and some rent stabilization mechanisms. It was debated in the Knesset several years ago and went nowhere. The landlord lobby is organized and well-connected. Renters are not an organized political constituency. They're dispersed, they're transient, and many of them are young people who vote at lower rates.
The parties that might theoretically represent them have other priorities. Security, religious-state relations, judicial reform. Housing policy is a second-tier issue for the political class.
Which is exactly the dynamic that sortition is designed to break. If you convened a citizens' assembly on housing in Israel, random, stratified by age, region, housing tenure status, you would get a body where renters are proportionally represented, where people who've been rent evicted are in the room, where the lawyer who owns her apartment and the family that's being pushed out of theirs have to sit together and deliberate.
The output of that assembly would almost certainly be more tenant protective than anything the Knesset would produce on its own.
The international evidence on this is consistent. When you put ordinary citizens in a room, give them balanced information, and ask them to deliberate on social policy, they tend to produce recommendations that are more egalitarian and more protective of vulnerable groups than the status quo. Not because they're radicals, because the status quo is sustained by organized interests that lose power in a randomly selected body.
The landlord lobby doesn't get a seat at the citizens' assembly unless the random draw picks landlords, and then it only picks them in proportion to their share of the population, which is small.
That's the design feature that makes sortition so threatening to concentrated interests. Elections give organized minorities enormous leverage. Campaign contributions, primary challenges, media campaigns. Sortition strips all of that away. There's no one to lobby. The assembly members don't need to be re-elected. They serve for a defined period and then go home. Their only incentive is to make a decision they can defend to their neighbors.
Which is also the vulnerability. If they don't have to face voters, what's the accountability mechanism?
The Irish assemblies deliberated in public. Their sessions were live-streamed. Their reasoning was published. The accountability is reputational. The assembly as a body has to justify its recommendations to the broader public. And the individual members are accountable to their communities when they go back home. It's not electoral accountability, but it's not nothing.
It's a different kind of accountability. Social, rather than electoral. You have to look your neighbor in the eye and explain why you voted to keep no-cause eviction legal.
Which is a harder conversation than issuing a press release through a communications director. The personal dimension matters. When you're an elected politician, you can hide behind party discipline, coalition agreements, strategic considerations. When you're a randomly selected citizen, you have to own your decision as an individual. The research on citizens' assemblies suggests that participants take this responsibility extremely seriously. Attendance rates are high. The quality of deliberation is, by most measures, better than what you see in parliamentary committee hearings. More genuine questioning. Participants in citizens' assemblies are not performing for a partisan audience or positioning themselves for a leadership race. They're trying to figure out the right answer. The deliberative quality surveys that have been done consistently find that citizens' assembly participants report high levels of satisfaction with the quality of discussion, feel their views were heard, and believe the process was fair even when the outcome didn't go their way.
Which is more than most people say about electoral politics.
And that matters for democratic legitimacy. If people believe the process is fair, they're more likely to accept outcomes they disagree with. Elections, in many democracies, are increasingly seen as unfair. not in the sense of fraud, but in the sense that the outcomes don't reflect the preferences or interests of ordinary people. Sortition offers a different path to legitimacy.
The theoretical case is strong. The empirical track record is promising but limited. The political obstacles are enormous. Where does that leave us?
I think it leaves us with a menu of options that are more realistic than full-scale parliamentary reform. The citizens' assembly model, temporary, issue-specific, advisory, is proven and politically feasible. Ireland has shown it can work at the national level on contentious issues. The Belgian model, a permanent citizens' council with agenda-setting power, is a more ambitious step that's being tested right now.
For the specific problem the prompt identifies, a parliament disconnected from the housing precarity of younger generations. A citizens' assembly on housing would at minimum force the issue onto the agenda in a way that can't be quietly smothered.
And at maximum, it could produce a reform package with enough democratic legitimacy that politicians would find it costly to ignore. Not impossible to ignore. The French case shows that determined governments can still bury assembly recommendations, but costly.
The French case also shows that the executive matters enormously. If the president or prime minister who commissions the assembly isn't committed to implementing its output, the whole exercise becomes an elaborate opinion poll.
Which is why institutional design is everything. The assembly needs a guaranteed path to implementation before it starts deliberating. Whether that's a referendum trigger, a mandatory parliamentary debate with a recorded vote, or something else, the follow-through has to be baked into the mandate. Otherwise, you're just paying 5 million euros for a focus group with better branding.
The focus group with a PR budget. That's a brutal but fair description of what happens when these things go wrong.
They do go wrong. The Canadian province of British Columbia ran a citizens' assembly on electoral reform in 2004. 160 randomly selected citizens, a year of deliberation, a clear recommendation for a single transferable vote system. It went to a referendum and got 57% support, but the government had set a 60% threshold for adoption, so it failed.
The threshold game.
You can design the process to produce legitimacy while ensuring the outcome doesn't actually change anything. The supermajority requirement is the political equivalent of a safety valve. It lets the steam out without moving the machinery.
The cynical view is that sortition only works when the political class already wants the outcome. Ireland's government wanted marriage equality and abortion reform, but needed cover. France's government did not want binding climate commitments and got cover for inaction.
That's too cynical by half. The Irish case is real. The citizens' assembly didn't just provide cover, it changed the terms of debate. The quality of public deliberation around the marriage equality referendum was substantially shaped by the assembly's work. People had a model of what reasoned, respectful discussion of the issue looked like. That's not nothing.
But for housing policy in Israel, where the political class is not looking for cover to act, a citizens' assembly would be pushing uphill.
Everything pushes uphill in housing policy. The landowners, the developers, the banks, the incumbent homeowners. All the concentrated interests are on one side. The diffuse interest of renters is on the other. The political economy is brutal, regardless of the institutional mechanism. The question is whether sortition gives renters a better shot than elections. And the answer is probably yes, because it removes the fundraising and re-election filters that amplify concentrated interests.
Let's talk about another dimension of the prompt. The generational disconnect isn't just about policy preferences. It's about what even counts as a political issue. The prompt mentions that the Knesset spends its time on grand questions of Jewish identity and state. Those are real and important. But for someone trying to find a stable home for their family, they're not the most pressing concern.
This is where agenda-setting power becomes crucial. In most parliamentary systems, the government controls the legislative calendar. The coalition agreement determines what gets debated and voted on. If housing isn't in the coalition agreement, it doesn't matter how many renters are suffering. Their issue doesn't reach the floor.
A permanent citizens' council with agenda-setting power, like the Belgian model, would be a direct counterweight to that. The council says, "We are debating housing this session, whether the coalition likes it or not."
The parliament has to respond. They can vote no. They can water down the proposals. But they can't pretend the issue doesn't exist. They have to go on record.
Which is more than renters get now. Right now, the issue doesn't even reach the agenda. It's not that the Gnesset debates tenant protection and votes it down. It's that tenant protection never gets debated at all.
That's the quiet violence of agenda control. The most effective way to maintain an unjust status quo is to never let the injustice be formally discussed. If it's never on the agenda, it never gets a vote. If it never gets a vote, nobody has to explain their position. The issue remains in the realm of private suffering rather than public concern.
The lawyer's story again. The lawyer didn't know what moving costs because she'd never had to think about it. The Gnesset doesn't debate tenant protection because the people setting the agenda have never lain awake wondering if their lease would be renewed.
The two phenomena have the same structure. It's not malice. It's not even indifference in the active sense. It's a failure of imagination produced by the homogeneity of experience in the decision-making body.
The sortition argument is, at bottom, an argument about imagination. You can't imagine what you haven't lived, so put people who've lived it in the room.
Give them the information they need to translate lived experience into policy judgment. The lived experience alone isn't enough. You need the expert briefings, the facilitated deliberation, the structured process. But the expert briefings without the lived experience are also not enough. You get technically competent policy that misses the human point.
The synthesis is the thing. Informed deliberation by a representative sample of the affected population.
Which is a pretty good working definition of democracy, actually. Better than the one we're currently using.
The one we're currently using is informed deliberation by a self-selected sample of people who are good at winning elections.
Which selects for a very specific set of skills and personality traits. Charisma, ambition, tolerance for fundraising, comfort with adversarial conflict. Those are not the skills you need to thoughtfully weigh housing policy trade-offs.
The glockenspiel of corporate approachability, but for politics.
We've built a political system that selects for performers, and then we're surprised when they don't govern well.
Where does this leave the prompt's deeper concern? The sense that the people passing laws about renting have never really rented in the current market, and the people who have are locked out of the process.
It leaves us with a diagnosis that's structural, not personal. The problem isn't that this or that politician is out of touch. The problem is that the electoral mechanism itself filters out the perspectives that need to be in the room. And the solution, if there is one, involves building parallel democratic infrastructure. Citizens' assemblies, permanent councils, deliberative processes that bring those perspectives into the decision-making process without requiring them to first win an election.
Which sounds utopian until you remember that Ireland actually did it. Belgium is doing it. Paris is doing it. These aren't thought experiments. They're functioning institutions with track records.
Modest track records, imperfect track records, but real ones. And they're getting better as the methodology improves. The OECD has codified the best practices. There's a growing community of practitioners who know how to run these things well. The technical capacity exists. The question is political will.
Which brings us full circle to the prompt's observation about critical mass. At some point, the people who can't get on the property ladder will constitute a majority of the voting population, and then the political calculus changes.
Assuming they vote their housing interests, which as we discussed is not guaranteed, but the demographic trend is real. Home ownership rates among young Israelis have been declining for years. In Tel Aviv, the idea of buying an apartment on a professional salary has become essentially a joke. The generational wealth transfer from parents who bought in the 1980s and 90s to children who can't afford to buy now is going to be the defining economic story of the next two decades.
If that story doesn't have a political voice, it festers. People don't just accept precarity. They get angry. They look for someone to blame. The political consequences of a generation locked out of housing stability are not going to be tidy.
No, they're not. And that's the argument for building the democratic infrastructure now, before the anger hardens into something less manageable. Citizens' assemblies are a safety valve, but they're also a genuine democratic innovation. They can channel frustration into deliberation rather than resentment.
The prompt asked about experiments in creating representative bodies that reflect perspectives, not just electoral outcomes. I think the answer is yes. These experiments exist. They're more advanced than most people realize, and they're producing real results. But they're not a substitute for political organizing. They're a complement to it.
They're not a magic wand. A citizens' assembly on housing in Israel would face the same landlord lobby, the same coalition politics, the same institutional inertia as any other reform effort. The difference is that it would change the terms of the debate. It would force the issue into the open. It would produce a set of recommendations with democratic legitimacy that goes beyond any single party or faction.
It would put a few renters in the room where the decisions are made, which, given the current composition of the Knesset, would be a revolutionary act all by itself.
Sometimes the most radical thing you can do is make the decision-making body look like the population it's supposed to serve.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1932, a radio operator in the Yukon named Frank J. Merrill detected a series of regular radio pulses that he believed originated from a fixed point in the constellation Cassiopeia. He recorded them for 6 nights before a solar storm knocked out his equipment. When he returned, the signal was gone. 3 years later, Carl Jansky's famous discovery of galactic radio noise was published, and Merrill's notebooks, which described frequencies and pulse patterns consistent with what we now know as a repeating fast radio burst, were never cited or investigated by professional astronomers of the era.
We might have discovered fast radio bursts in the Yukon in 1932 and just...
The notebooks are probably in someone's attic in Whitehorse. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps people find the show. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.